The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the third in our series of talks at Imperial College London, where we dissect the bones of the government's Tech City proposition, an initiative launched 1 year ago this week by Prime Minister David Cameron. I'm Alex Kratosky. The aim of this series has been to identify how much meat is on the initiative's skeleton. To what extent is this actually an issue that Number 10 is truly behind, demonstrating a can-do attitude to tackle the needs of the UK's digital technology sector, or a 21st century cool Britannia featuring today's geek rock stars? Part of our intention here at The Guardian has been to ensure that the people in charge engage with the real underlying issues that are being discussed in the coffee shops and pubs of East London and beyond, especially those issues that they have the power to change. So tonight's theme, intellectual property and ownership in a digital age, is possibly the most obvious example. The UK is globally recognized as a world leader in innovation in areas like music, in fashion, in design, and art. And it accounts for 6% of the UK's GDP, according to a recent Demos report. Yet British makers are struggling to make a buck in a landscape where their highly valued work can be infinitely replicated. How do we balance between the competing needs of the creative industry to protect themselves, but also stay open enough to ensure continued innovation? I'm joined by a panel of experts in the field who, by the end of the hour, should have addressed the most important parts of the issue. And of course, the Tech Weekly audience and listeners. Thank you very much. First, please welcome Professor Ian Hargreaves, author of the 2011 report, Digital Opportunity, a review of intellectual property and growth. And it is actually primarily referred to as a Hargreaves review. So it's very good to have you here. Tell us a little bit about the work that went into the report, rather than the actual findings, which we'll pick apart throughout the podcast.
Well, it was, by the standards of these things, a fast review. We were given 6 months from the back end of November 2010 to the end of April. We made that deadline. With that kind of deadline, it meant that we had to focus on what we thought were both the most urgent and the most important issues. So there's a lot of important things that are not discussed in detail in the review. The way it worked was that I was asked to lead it, but I was given the support of a team from the Intellectual Property Office, which is formerly known as the Patent Office, the body which administers the UK IP system. So I guess what you have in the review is a balance of a somewhat external perspective by me. I'm not an IP lawyer, I'm not an IP economist. I haven't spent my life contending IP issues. But I was working with a group of people who have that expertise, and I think the review, I hope the review, involves a balance between that kind of expertise and an external perspective which was designed to answer the big question that we were asked, which was, is there a way of altering the UK IP setup so that it will do an even better job for incentivizing innovation and therefore driving productivity and growth in the UK economy.
Next, the Minister for Culture, Communication and Creative Industries, Ed Vasey. Welcome, Minister. Thank you very much for joining us, albeit briefly. a couple of questions off the back of this. As Ian Hargreaves said, this was a very quick review. It started in November. The current administration was voted in May, and it was interesting because this administration was probably the only one that had a technology agenda from the get-go. So I'm curious as to, and it also comes off the back of the Digital Economy Act, so I'm wondering sort of what the impetus was of commissioning Professor Hargreaves to do this review.
I think it was very much a Number 10 initiative. There are people in the policy unit there who take very seriously the need for innovation, and the way it sort of filters through government is very interesting. On the one hand, we have an IP minister in Judith Wilcox, who's there to look after IP policy, and then you have me in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, there to protect, as it were, the creative industry. So in a sense, I have a double hat on, which doesn't always sit easily together. On the one hand, the industries that I feel that I represent, as it were, in government, be it film, music, television, video games, are industries that very strongly depend on IP and IP protection, which is why I'm responsible for the Digital Economy Act, for example. But on the other hand, the kind of new industries that we want to see and the innovators also want to use content and to have, as it were, a flexible approach without wishing to set too many hairs running.
So it was published in May. Where are we now with it? How far has it gone through government?
Well, consultation is about to start on the specifics of Hargreaves, led by the Intellectual Property Office to take through the recommendations and to reach conclusions as to which recommendations should be taken forward.
There was a government statement in August, wasn't there?
Was there?
There was.
It interrupted my holiday. I've never forgiven you.
Well, that was the one that Vince Cable did. Yes,
it
yes.
Yes,
it interrupted my holiday. I had to go to the British Library.
We've just heard the voice of Fergal Sharkey, who's the CEO of UK Music, which is the umbrella organisation that represents the collective interests of the UK's commercial music industry. Now, Fergal, the rights and copyright discussion is quite a fierce one, and one which we will touch on this evening, but I don't know how much it will dominate our conversation unless I let you run free with it. Political parties in this country and other countries are advocating radical copyright reform. It has been set up in other countries, and it has some success so far. How do you respond to that?
I'm not sure that that's the case. And I'm genuinely fascinated by the emotive language that people use on this, chilling effects and innovation. And I can't help when somebody uses the word innovation and tech companies being innovation. Well, what is it that every young artist, musician, performer, singer, songwriter, playwright, poet, journalist does when they sit down in front of a blank sheet of paper apart from innovate? So I think we have to expand that. The point I would like to make, I am actually really keen on the notion of self-reflection. And it's a good thing for an industry, music industry, film industry, government, anyone else, to sit and try and figure out, is there something we could be doing and should be doing better? So in many ways, the idea of a review of copyright or indeed access to finance or exports or anything else, for me, is a good thing. You may end up having gone nowhere, but it can be a very good exercise. It's slightly worn, and I'm not sure I completely agree with Ed's interpretation. The Hargreaves review did get off to a bit of a bad start, and it actually wasn't anything to do with anybody in this room. Where there was certainly a sector, and a not inconsiderably small sector, of the creative industries, when the Prime Minister announced this review and specifically made the comment about being told by the heads of Google that they would never establish themselves in the UK because of UK copyright law.
Well, I don't know whether they said that or not. Actually, in a slightly different way, though.
Well, I'm not sure that that's a truism, to be perfectly honest. For me, it overlooks 50 years worth of development and history and ecosystem in Northern California. Since the transistor in the 1950s, it creates an investment community. I think something like Google, YouTube, Yahoo, and MySpace got somewhere in the region of $50 million from Sequoia VC Fund alone, just in development and seed money. I don't see four young people with a brilliant idea in the East End of London right now getting £50 million worth of investment out of VC in this country. So there's 1,000 reasons that are completely unconnected with copyright law. Where I felt kind of empathy for Ian in many ways was that initial interaction was people already on the defensive. Where we've ended up, I think some of it actually is stuff that makes quite a lot of sense in many ways in some places, and some of it we've ended up with more questions. Two quick examples. Private copying, the landscape's changed, people's behaviour patterns changed, the law probably needs to change. Good, so can we not stop talking about that now and move on to the practicalities? Digital copyright exchange, do you want a register where you can go and look up, who do I need to talk to, I want to access these rights? Well, guess what, the music industry, we like databases. We've got two going back nearly 100 years. They make things more efficient, more productive, particularly distributing money to creators. If there's a better way to do that, well, why wouldn't we want to do that? I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to sit there and click a license that will allow me to set up an IPTV company and stream the BBC's rights to the Olympics.
Why not, Fergal? Is that possible?
Because I suspect the BBC and indeed LOCOG and maybe government and indeed the Olympics Committee might possibly have an awful lot to say about that. I suspect we'd end up negotiating.
Shouldn't stop us thinking about it.
Until 2 weeks ago, what was the market value for an iCloud-based music service? Well, the reality was nobody knew the answer to that question, because for the last 2 months there's been teams of people in Apple and teams of people in rights holders trying to figure out what that value might look like. So a week ago, we couldn't have even offered that if we wanted to, because nobody knew, including all the world's experts, until they figured that out. What I also keep in the back of my mind, and I think I did flag this with Ian a little while back, a year ago I was actually asked by the board of UK Music to go and talk to ISPs, tech companies, aggregators, to see if there was some kind of basic services, streaming radio service or whatever, that we could offer on that kind of off-the-shelf, just click here, UK Music website, enter your credit card details, print your license. The feedback I actually got from the ISPs, the tech companies and the aggregators was there was they had no interest in it. Everybody wanted their own unique service with some sort of value attached to it that would set them a place in the marketplace that they could use competitively to try to attract more customers to their unique service.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that, Fergal.
But very happy to.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about that and some of the practicalities of the alternative models. But I would like to introduce Professor Tom Hoon.
Professor Tom Hoon.
Thank you very much. From Imperial College, Imperial College's Intellectual Property Research Center. So tell me a little bit about what the IP Research Center does here.
Just to say that I've stepped in for Jonathan Haskell, my colleague, who was supposed to be here but fell ill. And the reason I mention him is because he's been doing some very important work for the IPO, for the Hargreaves Review, trying to measure the contribution of copyright industries or intangible assets in general to the UK economy. And he came up with some, you know, quite amazing results, demonstrating that we not properly measure the contribution of the film industry when we measure how much the UK economy produces. So the example is, you know, 20 million film investment when maybe the figure is more like 400. So the King's Speech was not properly captured. And that contribution means that government can base its decisions on better numbers, having a realistic assessment of the importance and the role of the copyright industries or the creative industries more general.
Tom, how much are you interested or focusing on the digital industries as well, the startup community that at the moment is focused in East London?
I'm interested because one of the things we do at our centre is looking at new business models and in connection with IP. So I welcome the Hargreaves Review because it makes a suggestion, look at the scope for a digital copyright exchange. And we should be taking that challenge and look at it. I'm looking at the moment at some data exchanges, which is a similar concept, digital cities. I think we have here Digital Economy Lab. We have a project looking at digital cities. How can companies, utilities, share data in order to improve the productivity of how a city is governed and run. I'm looking at it in context of the open platform, which is a sharing of environmental and climate change data where people want to collaborate. So the digital infrastructure today allows us to do things that we couldn't do, and we should explore them and test them. And that's what we are doing.
Representing the people at the coalface, the technologists themselves, is Jeff Lynn from the Coalition for a Digital Economy. I'm interested, Jeff, not only in what COADEC is and what its aims are, but also how the people on the ground, whether they view themselves as creative industries and how that can be integrated into questions of IP and digital copyright.
Absolutely. Great question. Well, just to start with a bit of background on COADEC, we were formed about 18 months ago as an all-volunteer organization to represent digital startups and SMEs on legislative and regulatory issues of concern to them. One of the things that we saw in the Digital Economy Act debate was that the creative, and I'll get to the distinction in a second, but the creative industries had a very sort of strong argument. There were the sort of libertarian, everyone should have open rights people making fairly strong arguments. But up the middle, which is where we see ourselves, were the people driving the digital economy, were the people who wanted to use digital technologies to promote growth, promote innovation, firmly free market, firmly pro-capitalism, but nonetheless not necessarily on the same page as some people in the creative industry. And that's what we were formed for, and that's what we've been trying to do. I agree very much with Fergal, and we've talked about this before, that the difference between a sort of tech entrepreneur working in Silicon Roundabout and somebody trying to start a new band or a new musician is very, very, very slim. The personalities are often the same. The attitude, I mean, it's, you know, I'm an entrepreneur myself. You have to be somewhat insane. The odds are stacked against you. You have to be a little bit crazy.
I would say passionate, Jeff.
Passionate, sorry.
Political speak, yes.
And so I don't believe for a moment that there is some natural tension or battle between the digital space and the creative space that, or at least an irresolvable one. There are issues that have to be discussed, and I think that one of the things that's gone on, especially with Professor Hargreaves' review, has been to take a set of laws or look at a set of laws that were just designed before there was a digital industry, before there were digital businesses, and just say, how do they really fit in today's world, in a world where you have both creators and digital innovators and a sort of mix of the two overlapping each other? How do those fit together? So I think there's a huge amount of similarity and collaborative potential with the creative industries. But I think it's important that, and one of the great things that the Hargreaves Review did was to join the two together and look at how to balance and how to work together for purposes of IP law.
Ed, I'm curious about in the face of cuts, in the face of a reduction in finance and those funding outlets, those funding opportunities, how can creative services produce quality new IP that isn't derivative and still retain the interesting IP?
The retention of IP is a huge question. It's something, for example, we're looking at in the film policy review, because obviously, as I'm sure the people in this audience know, that part of the kind of Faustian pact, if you like, for an entrepreneur is that when you're bringing your idea to market, often the first thing you have to give up is the IP that's going to make it incredibly valuable as you go forward. So I think where public money is potentially involved in pump priming an IP startup, if I can put it that way, you want to look very much at whether or not you can help that startup retain the IP. It is, to a certain extent, I think, the holy grail. I mean, I think, obviously, the public sector, in the widest sense, has an important role to play. I mean, clearly, universities and university research is incredibly important in that. Some government money going in through organisations like the Arts Council or, indeed, the British Film Institute is very important. I was at the BBC Academy last week, and they're still focused very much on training, but not just training, obviously, BBC employees, but working with a much wider range of organisations. Just a tiny example to give you the kind of things that I think we should be encouraging. You know, the T.S. Eliot Wasteland app, which has kind of taken off as this cult app from Faber and Faber. You know, it was the Arts Council and the BBC together that held a seminar with app developers in the cultural space to take the learnings from that. Now, I know that sounds like a slightly small and perhaps insignificant example, but it's that kind of flexibility of, you know, and the way we work now in this kind of, you know, in this world, the way we work today, of bringing people together to share ideas and experiences and build up that way, I think is very important to encourage.
Ian, I'm curious about what it is that intellectual property doesn't do at present.
Well, I think it's important not to fall into the trap of saying either, you know, the UK isn't good enough in the creative area, therefore you need to change everything to get it to be better, or not good enough in the tech area, you've got to change everything. When I went to Silicon Valley during the review, one of the things that I heard throughout Silicon Valley was how strong the UK is as a place of creativity in music, in television, in film. You know, it's true. So what my review is about is saying, here we have got the most successful creative industry sector in the European time zone, but it can be a lot more successful yet than it is. And the internet presents a massive opportunity for even very small firms, even in very odd places, far away from Tech City. Not every micro-organisation in the tech world is sitting next to Shoreditch roundabout. And I think that the question that has to be asked about the UK's creative industries and the digital scene is, why haven't they done even better? Why is the UK music industry not selling its wares even more effectively on new digital platforms? So I tried to give, you know, a couple of answers to that question in terms of things that might be done a bit differently. And the approach is all about saying, can we make these digital content markets work better? So they don't get bunged up by big firms with old business models who aren't necessarily that keen on innovating. They're more interested in protecting what they've got. They've got every right to do that, but a healthy economy allows newcomers to come in and chase them and harry them. And there's not been enough of that, or not as much as there could have been in the UK. The UK has taken a cautious approach to copyright reform, more cautious than many other countries in Europe. And that, to me, although that's always been rationalised as we've got this powerhouse sector, we must protect it, protect it, protect it. I believe that in the digital age, you have to say we've got this powerhouse sector. How do we ensure that it is going to be able to become even stronger in these new digital circumstances? That is the name of the game. And for me, everything flows from that.
Before Ed goes, I'd like to open this up to questions. So if anybody would like to pose a question, it'd be very interesting to hear your views on how to create this powerhouse that Ian's discussing, or even comment on some of the things that Ed is discussing.
Thanks very much. Technology has always created new markets for creators. I think we're looking at a very short hiatus where there's been a lot of friction and it hasn't. This is really illustrated in a really striking graph. If you compare Google's market capitalization and revenue with Apple's, Apple worked with creators. It worked really hard to create these new markets, made it really nice to spend money. Google has had what Ian Hargreaves might call a flexible attitude to copyright. I'm listening to the panel, and Fergal is a lobbyist. Every academic is implicitly a lobbyist because they look for where the breakfast comes tomorrow. Jeff is a lobbyist. And I've got an ear for special pleading coming here. Why do we have to? Why does one group have to lose out for another to succeed? Would it not be better if we didn't have anything called a digital policy? We simply looked at areas we did well and then concentrated on market growth from those.
Ed, would you like to?
Take the second question. I'll take them together. Was there a second question?
Hi, Caitlin Thaney from Digital Science. I used to manage the science division at Creative Commons, which I'm sure some of you are aware of. In intellectual property. But the organization that I'm a part of that was brought over, I was brought over from the U.S. to actually get off the ground, is all about sort of creating in the sciences this sort of environment that fosters an innovative sort of culture. From someone that does this in the sciences, I'd really encourage the panel to think about it as when it comes to intellectual property and also trying to bring over the startup culture as more of creating zones of certainty that people can play and releasing some of the restrictions that may hinder that sort of interactivity when it comes to content, whether it's in business or in content or in software.
Ed, I'd like to direct these to you.
I think you can link the two questions in a way. But, I mean, is this a hiatus? I think, to a certain extent, sometimes I do think it's a hiatus. It's, obviously, the internet is an extraordinarily disruptive source, and I give speeches every day about the amazing internet and trot out the usual statistics that you're all familiar with. So it's a massively disruptive force, in a sort of common sense way, I think we'll come out the other side and we'll see what emerges. And sometimes I wish I'd been born 30 years later because I'm quite keen to see what it's going to look like in 50 years' time. So I think that is true. And I think, to pick up on the second question as zones of certainty, and the first question is, why concentrate on any particular industry or have a kind of digital policy? I think they meet somewhere in the middle, which is, I think, that all business needs zones of certainty, and it's government's job to put those in place, be it competition law or employment law or whatever. And it just so happens that the creative industries, as effectively defined 13 years ago by Chris Smith, are broadly speaking industries that rely on IP to make money. They rely on, therefore, zones of certainty in terms of IP law. And I think that where, to a certain extent, Ian Hargreaves and Fergal Sharkey come together is to say there's nothing wrong, particularly in the digital age during a period of intense disruption, to look at those IP laws to see whether they're fit for purpose as this disruption is taking place. So I do think government is there to enforce, reflect and revise those laws so that people who wish to invest in IP and they do so, be it investing in new pharmaceutical drugs or in content, have certainty in terms of potentially earning revenue from that, just as if you invest by opening a bricks and mortar shop, you should have certainty by the enforcement of a lease law and other things. So in that sense, I do, to a certain extent, pick up on what both questions say by saying we are going through a period of intense disruption and a new model will emerge. And I've always said, by the way, that while I'm keen to protect IP laws, I'm not keen to protect old business models that are up to date. I don't think that's government's job. So I think we are in a hiatus. And I also agree with the second questioner. I don't think it's about importing Silicon Valley. What I think it is about is government getting behind high-tech startups and sending a message.
There's also an argument
that we are a
government
that wants those businesses to start here and for people to invest in those businesses.
There's also an argument for government to step out of the way.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I'm a conservative. I'm keen on deregulation when it comes to business as much as possible to give business as much flexibility as possible. And I'm not either particularly in the business of picking winners, but I think government can act as a broker. It can bring people together. It can make things happen. And I think talking about tech and careful initiatives, carefully targeted, can make a big difference.
Fergal.
Just to be clear, where I think there is some overlap of agreement here, but I just need to caveat something Ed said. From my perspective, UK Music's perspective, our goal and ambition is to grow the value of the online market, and in a way that benefits everyone. Clearly, Ed would agree with some of that. Ian, I think, would agree with some of that. It is not just a discussion about IP and copyright, and that's why I think we all miss a huge thing, and it's a real shame Ed just had to leave, because there are other ingredients that are involved in delivering all of that. Clearly, as we've heard about access to finance, both in the tech sector and in the creative industries, is a colossal issue. So you can have all the copyright form you want, but if the investment isn't going in, we're all wasting our time anyway. We are at a point, as Tom picked up, such as the state of government statistics about my industry in particular, that actually physically they're not worth the paper they're written on. Now, as Tom pointed out, Jonathan's work, for example, valued the investment in new music every year, I think it was about 224, 228 million. My internal numbers in the industry tell me that actually should look more like 2.2 billion. So how come government thinks it's 200 million and my internal numbers in the industry tell me it's more like 2 billion and what's going on there? If we could all just stop talking about this now, at some point, the creative industries, the tech industries, the ISPs, those young entrepreneurs in East London or young entrepreneurs starting record companies and publishers need to cooperate and collaborate together, and together they are going to drive the development of this market forward in a way that benefits them all. And I think we need to stop all this cowboys and Indians, the man wearing the black hat and the white hat and the Chilean effect type language and the disruption and everything else. The next time somebody says to me the music industry has to develop a new business model and then not actually tell me what that might look like, I think I'll scream. I have no idea. I have no idea. But let's face it, people tell me giving away streaming music and putting ads in it, that's a new business model. Well, that's called commercial radio, but just done another way. Amazon reminds me of something called the Britannia Music Club that I used to be in that I would write off every month and they would send me records in the post.
Tom, I'd like you to respond to Fergal's comment about the disparate or the differences between, you know, what Jonathan and the IP research have found and what's happening internally within the music industry in terms of these numbers.
Well, let me answer that, but also the intervention from the first question about, you know, we're all lobbyists. In a university, we teach and we present students with, you know, facts, figures, theories. And whenever I invite a speaker from the music industry, put them up there, whether it's the head of the BPI or somebody, and talk about, you know, the need to protect copyright in the music industry to extend the life of a copyright for sound recordings, and I ask people whether they're in favour or against, it's always very clear cut.
You know, you haven't invited me, Tom.
I will.
Because I teach too.
I'm happy to invite you, but be prepared for a very hostile audience who do not appreciate the case that you're making. And I'm just saying, this is the debate we're having.
Hostile audiences we like.
Can you elaborate on why? What is their hostility? Is it something to do with the culture? Is it something? How have things changed?
Well, there are a number of things that come up in these discussions. One is that the music industry benefited from the CD boom without doing much, actually, in terms of supporting the creative artists. It was a method of distribution that generated huge incomes. And then they are asking questions about...
As an artist that was signed during the 1980s, technically, for a fact, that wasn't true. And that's as an artist, by the way. But do carry on.
Then they say, you know, what are you doing for artists today? How are you supporting artists today? What are you investing? And are you adapting your business model, or are you just defending an old one? So the challenges are huge.
One of the things that's happening is that copyright is, because of the internet, starting to regulate copying in areas that are nothing to do with music and books and telly and publishing. It's starting to regulate, you know, copying, which is what makes search systems work, which what makes user-generated copy social media networks work, what makes possible basic computerized data and text mining, which is fundamental now to any kind of big data research type project. So these are areas where, if you are viewing this from an economic perspective, you say, okay, let's have a think about, did we intend all of this to happen? Insofar as things have happened that we didn't intend, is there now just some opportunity or need here just to pull back a bit here, pull back a bit there? How was it that copyright got us into a position where we have millions of works that nobody knows who owns them, therefore the libraries are not even allowed to copy them in order to preserve them? So these are actually nonsenses. They're nonsenses on stilts, which the politicians and policy has been unable to address for fear of damaging the absolutely legitimate and desirable interests of musicians and other creators to have a fair level of protection so that they can make a return from their own work. I don't disagree with Fergal about that at all, but I do disagree with the way that this machinery has spread, and it has become an undesirable regulatory restraint on the internet and on the internet's effects on the economy. And that is a very, very big risk for an advanced knowledge economy like the UK to run. In my view, we can't afford to run it, and it has to stop. It's urgent, and it's very important that the government takes the action that it's promised to take in response to my review.
Before I return to Fergal, who is chomping at the bit, absolutely salivating to get back on this, I do want to mention that Ed has had to leave us. But Jeff, I'd like you to respond to that, because you are the man who's representing everything other than the music industry on this panel. So if you could sum that up in 50 words or less.
Oh yeah, absolutely. first, just to respond to I think a point that's come up a few different times tonight. IP is not everything. It's not that if we fix copyright, we're going to all of a sudden have the most vibrant startup community in the UK. I don't believe that. Nobody believes that. It is one component of a number of things. The culture of risk is absolutely right. No question about it. It's something that's gotten better. It's gotten better in the few years that I've been closely involved in the UK tech scene. But that's key. Finance is key. A number of things are important. But just because IP isn't everything doesn't mean it's not something. And there are serious issues, in particular around copyright, that Professor Hargreaves identified. And I think it is very much worth addressing them. In terms of the sort of specifics, in terms of where things have gone wrong or not worked, I mean, I think that the general point that Professor Hargreaves made about copyright starting to apply to things that it was never meant to apply to is a really important one. I think we've got general consensus on that around things like orphan works. Broad, I know the photographers have a concern, but there's some broad consensus there. On other issues like data and text mining, I think there's still a good bit of sort of open space between the communities. But what I would say, what I would say from a purely sort of philosophical point is, look, the point of copyright, Statute of Anne, 1710, it's about encouraging learning and innovation. It always has been. And when you come up against an issue where copyright laws are starting to block innovation rather than enhance it, you have to reconsider and you have to rebalance them. I think the cases that I have seen among our constituents, among our people in the startup community, where that seems to be the biggest problem has been around data and text mining. Has been around parody. So many of you will know about the Lady Goo Goo incident from a week or two ago, but Moshi Monsters, which is one of the most successful, vibrant international, it's a games company, it's a social gaming company, had this character named Lady Goo Goo, looks a heck of a lot like Lady Gaga, clearly meant to be a parody. Lady Gaga's manager was not very happy, and now they're involved in a series of legal issues. That's something that at least needs to be discussed. I don't know what the right outcome is, but that seems to be causing problems. And then, you know, the other issue comes down to licensing, and I'll wrap up just quickly by saying I accept very much Fergal's point that UK music as an organization and the creative industries generally are coming to embrace digital methods of distribution much more. But I think there are a lot of us who are scarred still by the 10 years when they really didn't. And it was, especially for the large record labels, especially for the sort of BPI contingent, a time in which they were being disrupted and they fought tooth and nail against a heck of a lot of great innovations. And, you know, I think we still watch very warily. I'm not saying it's not getting better. I'm not saying there isn't a degree of collaboration. But I think we have a right to feel a bit scarred and a right to be a bit wary.
There is an element that's quite interesting here. We have quite a lot of time of copyright behind us. Right? We've got 300 years. We've got Statute of Anne. We have a lot to draw on. But we're also recognizing that those statutes were not future-proofed. How can we future-proof whatever it is that evolves now based upon the rights, based upon the properties, based upon the elements that we're discussing here, the creative outlets?
Okay, can I just very quickly pick up on some of the things that have been said? And I'll do it as quickly as I can, because it is important I do it. Parody, it's obviously such a huge problem. We've never managed to sell a single episode of Benny Hill, Monty Python, The Office, or anything else as a nation to the rest of the world. Clearly, we've no history of that. I'm fascinated by the way people pick up things like Lady Gugu or indeed Jay-Z. Somebody tells me that we upload 48 hours of video every minute onto YouTube. And if you type in Jay-Z, do it when you go home, type in Jay-Z parody, you will get 9,200 links coming back from YouTube alone. And somebody picks an issue because it was one of them, somebody asked to have it taken down. Well, where's the issue here with parody, what they're trying to get at? According to the economic impact study that accompanies Ian's piece of work, by creating a parody exception in the UK is going to generate £600 million worth of business for British television companies. It's rather interesting because PACT, the representatives of the independent television companies in the UK, absolutely disputes that number. Orphan Works is something that's covered by copyright that nobody can trace the owner. And just so you know, we did a grouping of people called the British Copyright Council, number of sectors and creative industry sit on it, 5 years ago, put a forward suggestion to government and how we could deal with that. So we actually agree there's an issue there, there's a way to solve it. Can we all just get on with it, please, and stop talking about it? Copying, I agree with Ian, and everybody does. The world's changed, people's behaviour's changed, and we probably need to look at copying, and certainly I personally, and I don't think UK music has any issue with people copying music. Where we are going to get into a discussion, at the minute the suggestion is the UK should be one of only two countries, in fact the only one, Ireland's the only one, that will introduce the right to privately copy and potentially will not compensate British creators. Now clearly we will be asking the question is why do 25 other countries in Europe seem to hold their creators in a slightly higher esteem than our own national government? Going forward, yeah. Copyright is always one of those things. It provides certainty for a lot of people. Yes, I can understand how tech companies want certainty, but also people investing in songwriters, composers, filmmakers, production. Copyright provides the certainty they get as an investor to make those productions happen. Copyright is the only thing that provides the investor any certainty they will recoup their investment in what is a ferociously competitive market. I think if any of us think we're bright enough to sit in this room or any other and design a copyright system over the next couple of months that will be absolutely bulletproof and future-proof for the rest of eternity, I'm certainly not that clever, and I would be more than willing to shake the hand of the man or woman that thinks they are.
Ian, not to suggest that you are going directly to there. He's just right there.
Well, I did come up with an idea about how to do that, and it involves trying to write into law the idea that copyright would not cover usages which are non-expressive in purpose, where it's not about the creator enjoying the benefits of the creative expressive material through copyright, there would be a get-out clause. Now, I recognise it's easy for me to write that, and lawyers will pore over the task if they're asked to do so, And it's not a simple thing to put down in law. But I do believe it is objectively where we need to go, because this is not an interlude. The digital revolution, on the crudest statistical basis, is not likely to be more than one third complete based upon the penetration of the internet globally right now. So we've got a long way to go with this. And from a UK point of view, if we don't get with the pace on legal adaptation, we will pay a significant economic price.
I'd like to open this out to questions now. We have about, I would say, 8 or 9 minutes, so we can take three questions, if you speak quickly. There's one there, and one over there. Brilliant, thank you.
Question is for Professor Hargreaves. Hi. I have a question. I want to know what three obstacles to GDP growth in that economy, in the digital economy, are being basically affected by the entire review that you conducted. I mean, what's one thing that they can do now that can be implemented so that we could actually see a change? And like Jeff said, I agree that it's not just intellectual property that's the issue. It's a lot of issues.
It wouldn't even be number one in my list. I mean, number one in my list would be getting the digital infrastructure right. That would be way ahead of intellectual property changes. But that doesn't mean to say, as Jeff said, because they're not everything, it doesn't mean they're not something. I mean, the calculations that the economists who pored over the review did suggested that, fully implemented, the review was worth between 0.3 and 0.6% a year on annual UK GDP. I'm not an economist, so I'm not trying to validate the number or not validate the number, but it doesn't seem to me to be a crazy number when you think that, according to recent work by McKinsey and others, the internet is reckoned to account for about 6% of the UK economy all up. The internet is a big factor in the economy. You know, common sense and daily life tells you that. So it's not surprising that, you know, that economists come up with numbers that are tasty to politicians when they evaluate these things.
The bit that I'm curious about is Ian, and indeed government ministers, got up and repeated that these reforms would deliver £7.9 billion worth of growth in GDP here in the UK. It's not true. By way of example, this report, an economic impact study, claims that by introducing private copying into the UK, it'll deliver £2.5 billion worth of growth. The reason that there's manufacturers and British tech companies absolutely afraid right now, because of the uncertainty of copyright law, to invent the next iPod. Well, I have to tell you, back in 1989, there was an absolute historic case, went all the way to the House of Lords involving Amstrad, which made it very perfectly clear the hardware manufacturer has no liability whatsoever. The theory is that if we unleash this thing, a tidal wave of British manufacturers will go out there and grab 50% of the global market of the value of the iPod market right now. It's not going to happen. As I've explained, 500 million for parity, it's not going to happen. Digital copyright exchange, another 2 billion. I have to tell you, in the background, people in the music industry have been working with the European Commission for almost 3.5 years now, developing what is going to be the global repertoire database. There is a large company right now actually out there looking at the implementation stage. They've got a report back. The feasibility has been done. It's finished. It's going to happen. It is progressing. And I did speak to them, and they almost laughed. The government repeated was going to deliver £2 billion worth of growth to the UK's economy. So I'm afraid to suggest that government's argument that this is going to deliver £7.9 billion worth of growth is a fallacy. The reason we're implementing this stuff, we're all going to be massively, massively disappointed.
Does this go back, though, to the question of the confidence that Brits have about, you know, taking their innovations and conquering the world?
Well, actually, we could sit here and, I suppose, play a little game of, I have some recollection of a little company called Poseidon, pretty much did invent the MPEG-3 player back in the early 1990s. But actually, the company itself and the management at the time thought it was too risky, thought there was no market for it, and didn't bother developing the thing for any further. I've also got some recollection that most of the R&D and research team and design team on that product, now kind of head of mobile communications, head of hardware and various other senior postings, a little company called Apple. We're back to that brain drain again. So is that actually more of the problem here in the UK? We're back to the investment argument. We're back to the lack of risk argument. We're back to the nurturing support for creators and entrepreneurs. And is that actually the issue we should be discussing here? And that's not about copyright.
Hi, Mike Dix from PACT. Thank you very much for the plug for the TV industry, Fergal. our point as the representatives of TV and film producers is that the model's not entirely broke. We are making money, and we're making money internationally. As Eric Schmidt pointed out at the Guardian lecture recently, we're very good at it, and Google would be very bad at it. But I do think on the tech argument and the tech city argument particularly, we get conflated with this idea that the tech guys are against the content guys. And I don't, I think we've done a very good job of showing that that isn't the divide, really. Because IP, as Google say, protects their business. The fact is, if we're going to grow startup companies that are going to take on Google and Facebook, which is what we should be doing in the East End, not ripping off TV shows and music to make a quick buck, we should be trying to actually make an alternative search engine and identity platform in the UK. If we're going to do that, we need IP laws to protect those companies to allow them not to have their software stolen by Google and Facebook. You know, it works both ways. If we change the laws to allow fair use of copyright, it means the East End artists that are producing stuff and sticking it out on the web, the record companies can just steal it and publish it, make themselves a website and just launch it. Why can't they do that? We've got to look at how we protect businesses and allow them to grow, and I think that's about creating IP, creating a database of that IP so that we can move quicker to sell it and license it, basically. I agree it needs to be quicker. That's what's happening in the marketplace nowadays. It's moving quicker, and the consumer wants it cheaper, free, quicker. And we've got to be able to deliver that. So we need less lawyers in the process, basically, and we need a database that allows us to do that and sell it quick.
Jeff, as somebody who is an entrepreneur yourself, and as somebody who represents the entrepreneurs in Tech City, what are they doing with regards to this? How are they protecting themselves, or is there an attitude of just go out there and give it away?
Well, look, a lot of the businesses and the real sort of early stage startups that we deal with and interface with. Have so many concerns on their plate that protecting their own IP is low down on the list. And it's not that it's not important, it's not that it's not something that they would look to deal with later on, but it tends not to be a priority. That's not necessarily an argument. I don't think that IP is unimportant, and I don't think you'd ever get from me or from anyone on this panel a notion that you need to or that IP laws should be thrown. I think everybody realizes, including in the digital industry, that IP is important. There's a very, very big difference, though, I think, between the general consensus that it is important, and then understanding what the IP laws actually need to look like. And that's, I think, very much at the core of Professor Hargreaves' report. I mean, I disagree with the notion that if we had fair use, at least in the U.S., in the U.S. sense, that people could just start ripping things off. It's kind of a moot point. I mean, the report, and I think the proposals coming forward, don't even contemplate fair use. They contemplate specific sets of exceptions that are meant to address specific types of issues. And I don't think that having that debate and trying to strike that balance in any way, shape, or form leads to things being ripped off. I think there is a way to do it. So that both the IP that's important to digital industries, IP that's important to creative industries, and IP that's important to consumers, frankly, which is a whole separate issue, can all be maintained.
Yes, I'm a songwriter personally. When it comes to, for example, certain sites in America, when it comes to the takedown process for small content creators, it's completely. It's completely pointless to try to get your stuff off of a site. They know that as a small content creator, you don't have the money to get a lawyer to go and get them and sue them or get them to take it down. So it's you're completely ignored. So whether we have fair use or not here, our content is being accessed in this country through the fair use, even though we don't have fair use here, and there's no way for small content creators to actually do anything about it. Is there anything that you've been thinking about regarding this, Mr. Hargreaves?
Yes.
There needs to be a sort of civilizing force which occurs, and that is not possible in an atmosphere where you've got the creative people saying yaboo to the people who run the internet, and the two sides not talking, and government, frankly, in recent years, finding it impossible to set rules. And you know, we now have an opportunity to set these rules. I think the atmosphere is better. There's not agreement in every detail, but it is an opportunity, and boy, should we take it.
This is an unfortunate area or an unfortunate place in which we must end. The debate could continue and does continue in many, many different platforms. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our panelists, Ed Vasey, who's not here, but we can applaud him in absentia. Professor Ian Hargreaves, Fergal Sharkey, Jeff Lynn, and Professor Tom Hoon. Thank you. Do keep your eyes on guardian.co.uk/techweekly for more information on the next Tech City Talks, and tune in next Tuesday for our regularly scheduled programming. I'm Alex Krutowski, and the producer was Scott Cawley. Thank you very much to our audience, very lively audience. Good bunch. At least you didn't bring your rotten tomatoes like you did last week. And also to our panel. Good night.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.